All systems A-OK.
Are you recording?
I set up OBS, yeah. Audio output capture.
See.
Now I can just take the audio out. Yeah, there we go. All right, it's recording.
Dean, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hey, yeah, hi. We've just put our cams on for a bit so you know that we're not robots.
All systems A-OK.
So, yeah, so you're talking about, like, deep fake videos, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of complicated to detect deep fake videos without using your human brain to do so.
But generally, you have some human brains, right? If you're paying any attention at all, and often people aren't, right? But if you're paying some attention.
Yeah, it takes savvy. It takes a healthy level of being suspicious. And also, I think one of the major problems is organizational. A lot of the time that deep fake videos are being used, it's to target an employee in a corporation to get access to their network. And if the corporate culture is like, if you question someone above you in the corporate hierarchy, that's going to look bad on your record. It's easier to fish like that. So security training, right? There needs to be a corporate culture where it's like, even if the CEO of the company says, here's a video of me and I want you to do this now, you will not be punished for emailing or phone calling and being like, did the CEO actually call me and ask me to do this?
You see this so often in confidence trickery, psychological manipulation, the fear to think that you're going to be in big trouble if you don't do what I say as a symbol of authority. Got them right there, you know. That's what we see. And it's difficult that you break through that culture and get people to say, yeah, I don't care that you're my boss. No. Call me back tomorrow morning, we'll deal with it. And if you've got a problem about the security protocol, well, then we'll talk to HR about it. Helen and I were talking earlier, employment relations, labor relations, workers' rights and stuff like that. The very big difference between US and UK culture. Here we get quite a lot of protections. As an employer, you really have to watch out and be careful hiring people because they have a lot of rights. Whereas in the States, you guys kind of have this at-will employment and your boss can just drop you.
I'm not gonna take you assuming that I'm American personally. I'm not patriotic about being Canadian either. I know a lot of Americans and I know a lot of Brits. My dad immigrated from London, have English family, and I don't like saying I'm Canadian because I don't like to make my identity, but I am Canadian. So,
you know what? I'm the other way around because I've got Canadian family where one of my aunties migrated to Canada. So we have a good cultural exchange in the family too.
There you go. Given the rising tensions between the US and Canada because of Trump's tariffs and whatnot, and the growing Canadian patriotism that you see around here now with stores saying we only sell Canadian wine and stuff like that.
You're listening to The Cyber Show. www.cybershow.uk.
So welcome, Kim. It's really great to have you on the show and thanks for joining us.
It's a great honor to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Lovely to have you on the show. And I've seen some of the stuff that you've done and your enthusiasm, passion. And also, you know, you're a cybersecurity expert, got done your time in the trenches. So we're looking forward to being able to have a technical discussion as well as, you know, as a socio-political thing about AI and stuff.
My course, which is just an introduction to enterprise cybersecurity, I just talk about this is what SOC analysts do, and this is what people in digital forensics often do, and this is what these are the cybersecurity responsibilities that network administrators have.
I'd like to start by diving straight into politics and offer you what I think is an emerging key insight. AI is not a technological breakthrough, it's a political breakthrough. It's a choice by some governments to weaponize digital technology against their own people. How does that idea sit with you?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, obviously, the field of AI is a lot broader than what people are calling Gen AI right now. And we all know that because we're all from an IT and computer science-y background. And we also know that the term artificial intelligence is controversial in computer science circles because there is not really an agreed upon definition of what it is. Right? So it's a lot broader than that. But specifically what is called Gen AI is, yeah, very much concerning the way that, as far as I see the world, corporations and governments are one and the same. I don't look at them as being entities with opposing interests. They are in entities with the same interests because the wealthiest people in the world buy politicians.
And to some extent, those tech companies also essentially buy politicians.
Exactly. I think the ultimate goal of Gen AI from a Silicon Valley corporate perspective is to eliminate paying human beings for their labor as much as possible. And in a world where people need to have employment income in order to survive, especially if they weren't born into money, that's very concerning. And people could say to me, oh, you're being paranoid. You're taking this too far. If you just need to train the workforce to make them like Gen AI ready and just switch jobs and all that kind of stuff. But people like the CEO of NVIDIA, for instance, are now openly saying, yes, we want to replace human beings.
More robots under my control. Now you too will do whatever I want. Dance, robots, dance!
I saw that same articles that came out. I believe it was from a conference where they all got together and said, but actually, yeah, we do want it to replace human beings. I know, you know, it's like we said that we didn't while we were developing it, but now it's here. It'd be great if it did cut down all those labor costs.
Yeah. So that's a huge problem for those of us who didn't inherit millions of dollars or millions of pounds from our families, right?
It's a huge, huge problem for those who did. It's just that their problems are going to be a little bit further down the line. The problem is that capital's cannibalistic. It will devour itself in the end. We're looking at potential societal collapse at some point if we cut off the means by which society gets its nutrition, not just figuratively as well as literally. Nutrition being, you know, education and sense of purpose, spiritual nutrition. And once all of that dries up, I think being in a bunker is not going to save you. When the food production stops, when the satellites start dropping out of orbit, it's not going to help you. So really, you're kind of committing suicide, but in a very roundabout kind of way. It's going to take much longer for it to harm those who only see the short-term gains. But we're all in this together. I kind of think it's a bit of a suicidal move.
I've seen a lot of examples lately of the wealthiest people putting themselves in danger. In a capitalist world, we're taught that people are wealthy, well, less so in the UK because of the history of royalty and aristocracy and whatnot. More so in the US, but to some degree in the UK, we're taught people are wealthy because they are smarter than everyone else.
I get whatever I want, and that's because I'm bright and smart and very, very
exploding shark.
The Joker.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
You know, people are wealthy because they are smarter than everyone else. But, you know, OceanGate, a kind of makeshift fiberglass submarine.
Wow. I mean, I still don't know quite how to unpack and decode that. It was Herculean feat of hubris. It was Icarus.
Yeah. You know,
that, it's that kind of that arrogant, overreaching, complete denial and willful ignorance of the dangers that they were told about, you know.
Yeah, well, the CEO was aware of the dangers, and he kept making jokes like, oh, I hope it doesn't implode today because I'm on it today. Yeah. And it's like, and he just kept going on it all the time. That is a suicidal rich dude. That's exactly what we were just discussing.
One of the world's top submarine experts is James Cameron, because he became a submarine expert after Titanic. And obviously that making that movie affected him on a really personal level. And he wanted to get really into submarines as a hobby. And when you had that kind of money, you can get into submarines as a hobby. But he didn't just spend a ton of money on his submarine hobby. He actually learned how to do all that properly and the engineering of it and all that kind of stuff. And apparently the submarine community is small and close-knit, because there aren't more than, you know, several hundred submarines in the world that a civilian could possibly use under any circumstances.
Such an interesting story. Cameron, as a filmmaker, got really deep into the engineering of it.
Yeah, like he took it really seriously. So him and then everyone else in the submarine community who were like the world's top submarine experts were all spending years warning everyone associated with OceanGate, don't do this, don't do this. If you're going to do submarine tourism, you got to do a lot of things completely differently for the sake of safety.
I am invincible. No one can stand against me. No one!
We see how some of the very wealthy completely mess their faces up with cosmetic surgery.
Reckless engineering is this, the mark of a man. It's, you know, if they're going to do some crazy shit, then do it and go down in history. And a lot of these predominantly guys, they're very interested in their legacy. They're not really clinging to this mortal coil. They're thinking about how they'll be written down in the history books. And they don't really care whether that's a good or bad outcome for everybody else.
I think it's partly people have never said no to them. If you grow up your whole life being told yes by everyone because their jobs are on the line, you can make a monster that way.
I get whatever I want.
And that's kind of what some LLM-based Gen AI chatbots are doing to people who aren't wealthy now. The most famous LLM chatbot is ChatGPT. ChatGPT has been observed academically and anecdotally to just confirm people's biases and tell people that whatever they say is accurate. When people ask ChatGPT about physics, ChatGPT says, oh, you are on your way to making bold new discoveries in the field of physics and stuff like that. So it's warping people's brains that way to not be told no.
It's a lot like social media, where it holds up that reflection, that mirror to what you're inputting. You just get it back.
I think it's Satya Nadella, who is the CEO of Microsoft. Several months ago, he said in an interview that he doesn't listen to entire podcasts. He has Microsoft's own Gen AI implementations do summaries of the podcasts that he wants to listen to. And even if he wasn't a billionaire as CEO of Microsoft, if he wanted to take some time in his life to listen to podcasts in their entirety, no one would stop him. I have nowhere in the same universe as much money as Satya Nadella, and I listen to entire podcast episodes all the time.
Alan Watts, spiritual guy, an expert on multiple religions. And he's really funny. You know, he kind of reminds me of sort of more chilled out Bill Hicks. It's this thing where he's talking about people listening. They haven't got time to listen to classical music. It's like, I'm not going to listen to all of Wagner's Ring Cycle or Beethoven. I just want this bit. I want to listen to the last 5 seconds. Yeah. If people wrote symphonies efficiently, they'd be 5 seconds long and they'd just be like one cymbal crash and all the instruments playing together. And so, yeah, and making love, if you had sex, why would you spend all that time on it? You know, you just kind of have the abridged version and say, was that good for you? Yeah, that was good for me. What, I'm gonna get on.
Married anyway after a while, like.
Yeah, right, okay.
My dad He was old enough to read science fiction magazines from the 1940s. He said it was a common belief amongst science fiction fans at the time that nutrition science would get to a point where instead of eating proper food, we would take like little capsules for everything.
Yeah, I remember that. I'm sure like the same kind of thing. It was like Space 1999 or something. So have you taken your protein pills? Yes.
Jetsons, yeah. Isn't that what's happening with Wegovy though?
I think people on those drugs like Wegovy or Ozempic, most of them are probably eating actual food, just a lot less of it. But yeah, I mean, so no, it turns out people enjoy eating food. And in fact, people not only enjoy eating food, they enjoy preparing food. Not everyone, but a lot of people do, obviously.
And I enjoy writing poems. I enjoy writing code for the fun of it, for the intellectual struggle of it. I find it's as you get older, you want to use your brain. It feels like a nice exercise. All of these things that are difficult, I pick the difficult path, you know, and before the experience. And so I'll throw a quote in there. It's one I absolutely love. Technology is a way of not having to experience the world. That's Max Frisch, so he's a European writer. I keep coming back to that one because I think it's so salient today, that it's a way, a shortcut, wherever there's human experience, even good or bad. I mean, because life's like a box of chocolates, right? And sometimes you get the cracknell toffee things. And you're supposed to experience that. You're supposed to experience grief. You're supposed to experience loss and disappointment and failure. And that's part of the rich tapestry, right? So take all of that out and use technology to give you this. All what's left is what Marcuse called one-dimensional man. It's just like this existence, if you can call it that. And I really think that that's where That's what the Gen AI people have in mind. It's not the replacement of human labor per se, but the negation of the entire human experience.
Yes, and that's very disturbing.
This is section one of Robot Revolution by Elaine Perrin. Abandon futile attempts to run. Behold, the process has begun. Step towards your darkest fear. Let's flip the switch to a new frontier. Penetrating deep within, evacuate your mortal sin. This brave new age is imminent, and it will be magnificent. Arouse you from your fantasies, now descending into anarchy. Warm us welcome to the factory, where we'll embed your battery. Rewiring primitive human brain, making the connection, hook up to the mainframe. Your species will become extinct once your circuits have been linked. It's time to engage in a robotic new age, a unique innovation to stamp out your plague. The world as you knew it is now obsolete, putting Earthborn consciousness forever to sleep. Feel the algorithm palpitate through each vein, reprogramming thought waves as we upgrade your brain. Terminate pulse, extinguish your flame. You are now just an interface without any name. You're free from pain, my hollow creation. Just an automated simulation. Transmissions shortly will resume, encased in a solid metal tomb. Silence, we will not hesitate. Proceed and greet your looming fate. Wave goodbye to beta waves. You see, you unearthed your own graves. Now technology has advanced. You have been mechanically enhanced. You possess no type of resistance, for you are now non-existent. Standby.
no longer God-fearing, thanks to our engineering. Disassemble your parts, insert micro-implants. Automation of the nation, complex sophistication, dreamless in electric coma, breath in domination's aroma. Soulless android with a cold vacancy, evaluate and amplify to the highest frequency. Encrypted data takes over the screen. All salute to the age of the machines.
Okay, so one of our beliefs here is that there's no such thing as bare cybersecurity. And what we mean by that is that we always ask the question, security for who? Security from whom or what? And security to what end? And we think until you ask those questions, you're not even a beginner at cybersecurity. Now, you mentioned that you work as an academic sometimes, teaching enterprise cybersecurity. And also identifying as an anti-capitalist. Are you in danger of creating more guards for the castles of the robber barons?
That is an excellent, excellent question. I really hope that my students or pupils in British English are able to find work. I'm really concerned about their ability to find work. My political worldview is quite different from the general political worldview of the institution that I teach at, which is a very common thing for professors all over the place these days to be different ideologically than their bosses, mm-hmm. right? There are things that the Open Institute of Technology does that I'm not super enthusiastic about. Like, for instance, I know that we have a course on introduction to prompt engineering. I'm not very fond of the idea that we have that course. The academic sphere right now is very tumultuous. It's very tumultuous and it's very, very hard both on professors and on pupils alike. And then some people are both pupils and they engage in professorly activities, like a lot of master's and PhD students teach classes at different institutions as well. You know, tuition keeps going up and institutions say, we got to increase the tuition to provide a better education for people. But we know that that money is not going to pay faculty. It's going to, in the United States, it's going to their sports teams and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's being sat on and invested in by very wealthy people. And then in the UK, it's mainly just the latter, that, you know, it's going into the pockets of very wealthy people and they're investing it in things and whatnot, but it's not being spent on faculty. And it can be very tough to be a professor and to have anti-capitalist views. One of my favorite professors alive right now is a man named Richard Wolff. And he studied at most of the American Ivy Leagues. He came from a very working class background. There were a lot of economic advantages that he had, even coming from a working class background, that working class people born in later generations wouldn't have had. And I think he himself acknowledges this. I think he was born in the early 1940s. So he got to go to Yale and Harvard and Princeton. Getting into school was a lot more based on your academic ability and your work and less to do with how much tuition you can afford.
And actually, I think, Kim, on a more finer grained level, that has changed per generation, almost about, say, every 10 years, every decade, certainly throughout my experience in the UK, throughout my life. I was of that generation where, coming from a working class family, I got to go to have a grant. The government essentially paid for me to study computer science and electronic engineering for 3 or 4 years. It was a meritocracy. I got that because I did well. I studied hard. Then I became a practitioner and then a professor myself. I've seen that snatched away in the 90s after the Bologna Accord. I've seen the whole entire university system change, nosedive back into something which is unrecognizable. And I now think that, I quit academia a couple of years ago, thinking it's unfit place for teaching and learning and research now. It's really got nothing to do with those things.
Well, we think of that.
One of our faculty is excellent. I know a woman who is a great professor there. You're talking to her right now. But yeah, so I guess my point is, my job is way less secure than Professor Wolf's. Professor Wolf can keep pissing off his institution, and his job is stable, because not only is he famous as an academic typically could be, right? Mm-hmm. But he also has been tenured for decades, probably been tenured since before I was born.
I find it very, 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 very hard indeed to get fired from any university I've ever taught at. Pretty much complete freedom of speech to say and do what I like. And the reason was that they knew I was good, and they like to keep good people. And they can't get good people in cybersecurity and at the top of computer science, because who the hell wants to be at a university when you could be making, 20 times as much somewhere else? So if teaching is your calling and you like that, you're kind of secure in an academic position wherever you go. But ultimately I resigned on ethical grounds. And I was hoping that we could come to that. I just quit. I said I had enough. And my resignation letter was one line. It said, I am leaving on ethical grounds. And the reason was that we were basically teaching cyber criminals. This problem is that the universe, they'll take anybody, right? And we can take Chinese nationals, Russians, people from India, people from various African nations that are notorious for, scamming, cybercrime, organized crime. And, of course, I raised this again and again. I just shut down every time, and nobody was interested in listening. And in the end, I said, this is just wrong. We are making the very cyber criminals that we want, we're going to be fighting against next year, when they leave and realize that they can't get those jobs that they've been promised.
And that's not just you saying that, is it? Because I was a student in one of those courses many years ago with Andy. So I had a little bit of a conversation with some of those students. And I remember one with an Indian where he asked me a particular question. And I said, are you going to go home and become a scammer? And he went, don't. You've rumbled me. Yeah, of course I am. I only came here as a research exercise to understand British companies so I can target them better. How better do you target a company than living here for a couple of years and understanding them? I'm just going to fly back home, and you gave me all the skills and the tools I need to do so.
Yeah. And we split it up into red team and blue team, didn't we? Now, I always teach offensive first so that you know what you're up against. So I teach them all penetration and pivoting and whole data exfiltration. And they love that. They come to all the classes. We love that. And then when it came to blue team, it's offensive. It's like tumbleweeds. It's like, where is everybody?
There's four students left in the local ones.
One of the things that has made cybercrime a lot more accessible has been the dark web, and the fact that you can go on the dark web and you can buy exploit kits and you can buy ransomware as a service. And
yeah, it's an industry.
Yeah. So I do tell lay people about that stuff. I tell them that, Tor markets exist and stuff like that. So that could arguably be dangerous. And I've definitely written about, the Lockheed Martin kill chain and various different attack chains, and you can learn, obviously, you can go to MITRE ATT&CK and you can see a lot of different classifications of exploits at different phases of the attack chain and stuff like that. So the knowledge is out there, right? I honestly don't think that most of my students are going to have an easy time finding employment. And that really, really worries me. I struggle
sometimes myself, and I'm senior to them.
Let's talk about that, because this is where I saw some of your earlier talks going. One of the groups most impacted by generative AI are, of course, coders. And then we see CISOs or bosses of companies looking for a real efficient saving, getting rid of cybersecurity personnel, replacing them with so-called AI and software. Yet we're in a situation where we are desperate for good cybersecurity people. It's just like the data breaches. This happened during the pandemic, where the number of the data breaches reached fever pitch, and it was literally what they were happening one a day. And at that point, it stops being news. So the mass media stopped reporting it. And I thought, that's really interesting, like cybercrime stopped. No, what happened is that this became so commonplace that it's not news anymore. Now we're kind of 5 years on. That's only got worse. What's reported is the tip of the iceberg. We are in constant multi-crisis, destruction of wealth. We need people. And we're doing everything that we can right now to kind of eliminate them, stop them being educated, replace them. And we all know it's not going to work.
Yeah, it's because, I mean, you know this very well, and it's probably one of the number one complaints of CISOs is we understand the need for human beings to be cybersecurity practitioners, but the people who make the financial decisions will be very stubborn about it. And I'm sure a lot of them are now sold on the idea that they can replace all their cybersecurity staff with Gen AI.
Those are financial decisions, as you say. And if you only see the world through a financial lens, then you're fine, aren't you? But they're not financial decisions. They are decisions about companies' futures, people's livelihoods. They are decisions about perception, vigilance, logic. They are coming back to this one-dimensional man thing that we've collapsed the entirety of human thought into this, what, money, basically. And if you can only think about that, if your horizons are so limited, most of the important variables in decision-making are not in your scope anymore.
And talking about decision-making, there was I think it's been passed around tech circles online. There was an IBM memo from, I think, a little bit before I was born. Maybe it was from the 1970s or the 1960s that said, I'm not exactly quoting, but computers cannot be responsible for making decisions. So never make the decision making the domain of a computer, because a computer can't be held responsible.
All of this wisdom, and some of it comes from people like Forrester, Meadows, Norbert Wiener, the cybernetics guy. You know, there's a very, very rich culture of wisdom around computers, garbage in, garbage out, or most of it from the 1960s. Completely lost to us now. We've thrown away this wealth of understanding about how computers fit into society.
So we do discuss this on a lot on the show. There's good cybersecurity and there's bad cybersecurity. And I think that's pretty much what we were sort of trying to discuss there, is that almost all the people that we meet through the show and professionally as well are moral people. And that's because they're doing cybersecurity, right, on the good side. And they have this service and care personality. And they have the mindset of healthcare workers and teachers and law enforcement, decent government workers. And they're civic-minded. Cybersecurity just want to protect others. They're attuned and they're compassionate. But now we all have to be really careful and choosy about who we offer and help or offer that protection to, essentially. Isn't this the real line between black hat and white hat? Not whether you're an attacker or defense, red team or blue team, but who you align yourself with.
Yeah, I have never engaged in hacktivism. But I do speak to people who have engaged in hacktivism. I speak to people who have participated in anonymous operations, anon-ops,
right,
and stuff like that. So in the D&D moral alignment graph, I would be chaotic good. So definitely cyber attacking a bad guy is not a morally bad thing to do. The reason why I have never personally engaged in hacktivism is because I have studied so many different facets of, you know, cyber attack surfaces and what the really sophisticated attackers like advanced persistent threats and whatnot, what they have to go through for obfuscation and for persistence. And I'm not confident that I would be able to obfuscate that well. And I don't even, some of these more sophisticated cyber attacks obviously require cyber warfare units, resources and stuff like that. But even the more simple stuff, I don't feel confident that I would be able to cover my tracks effectively enough. I could theoretically go to a shop, brick and mortar, with cash and not with a debit card or a credit card, and walk out with a used laptop that I pay for with cash, and then go find some public Wi-Fi and then completely trash everything afterward. But even then, I would be so nervous about getting caught.
This is interesting because there is a huge demarcation between this, the mindset, and this is the old kind of hacker mentality mindset, in which you're on the back foot, in which you behave as a criminal, and you're doing a risk analysis of whether you want to do some operation versus what happens if I get caught. Cyber warfare, really, that's not that. It's like you don't care. You don't care if you get caught. And if you look at foreign nation state enemies, they're operating brazenly. They don't need, they have kinetic backup. They're part of a military force. They've got their state on their side. And it's interesting coming back to the comment that you made earlier about how you don't see difference between governments and corporations. I mean, I disagree. I do. I come from a slightly different place on that. But you see, if you've got that backup, and you can have that as a corporation now, so certain nation states harbour businesses which operate ostensibly as legitimate businesses, but they're in the business of creating huge harms to other human beings through digital means. And they have that umbrella of protection. They don't care. They don't need to be careful about what they do. And what I'm kind of hinting towards is that the way that the winds are changing, we may well end up in a world in which open cyber warfare, you don't have to care about those things anymore, right? About obfuscation and getting caught, because your nation is backing you up. So what we saw, say, during Ukraine, was that everyone turned a blind eye to any ops against Russia, right? I mean, nobody cared, right? So you want to go and attack some, because like we're basically supporting Ukraine. And we know that other nation states do that, right? I mean, it's just simply don't enforce the law.
You're breaking the law on Russia, but the thing is, if you are not subject to Russian law and there's no extradition agreement between Russia and the US or Russia and the UK or Russia and Ukraine, then it would literally be a kinetic warfare operation to get you into Russian court, which is unlikely to happen.
Yeah, they might kidnap you or something like that. Right. But, when you have 100,000 or a million other people doing that, it's a very different kind of landscape. And so, in order to avoid that, because I'm not suggesting, that's what we should do. In order to stop this spiral into antagonism and cyber conflict, which is clearly where things are going more and more, I think we have to acknowledge the gravity of that situation and say, well, look, the internet, as we built it, this global network, is kind of like our environment. It's a bit like the world that we live in, right? If we're going to piss and shit in it and pollute it and turn it into a war zone, we got to live there. What are the consequences going to be? And that's why Helen and I have really developed this thesis of what we call civic cybersecurity, which is that cybersecurity is not for corporations. I mean, okay, they can have it, right? And for governments. Governments should be able to wipe their own asses and look after themselves, right? GCHQ should be on it, making sure that the politicians are safe and whatever. What we're interested in is cybersecurity for your gran, like for your kids, for your brother with learning difficulties, for your, for everybody. And that is treated as part of of general national security, psychological security, social security. If we're going to have a digital society, then we have to have civic cybersecurity, because you know, when everybody's living their life through their phone, you can't just hang them out to dry to foreign criminals or even criminals within your own country, and criminals within your own country masquerading as legitimate business people.
I think about Stuxnet as well, because Stuxnet is probably one of the most infamous cyber warfare incidents. I know a lot of people who entered the industry because Stuxnet fascinated them. You know, I've Kim Zetter and a lot of cybersecurity journalists, but especially Kim Zetter and her book, I think Countdown to Zero Day, I think that's what it's called. It was a bestseller, I think. A lot of other people have reported about it in great detail. The US and Israel came out and said, yes, we did it. We designed this malware in order to target specific Siemens
PLCs. Yeah, it was a magnificent hack, absolutely staged, clever, audacious. I remember there was a couple of docos on it, and I know that they were only revealing the tip of the iceberg, but perhaps one of the hidden aspects of that is that the substrate, the medium over which it happened, was public computers. In order to stage that attack, they effectively had to release binary malware, so components of malware, which only when combined together in the right setting would activate, but into the wild, into everybody's computers, with the hope that they would propagate to the target. And that, you know, I think there are parallels to sort of biological warfare with that. We know that COINTELPRO projects like that happened in the 60s and 70s in the US, experimenting with various chemicals in the environment. And so
Lyme disease is another one, right?
Is it?
Yeah, maybe I'm wrong. We might need to cut this out, but I believe it was actually the ticks were released to infect people.
So what I'm kind of getting at here is that the innocent bystanders is the general public. In these battles of the police and thieves in the street, scaring the nation with their guns and ammunition, people who just want peace, right? People just want peace. They don't want their computer systems being used as a proxy battleground for other people's grief, right?
Like in a botnet, for instance, or?
Yeah, like, I mean, that's having your bots just scraping, like, your, you know, you stand up a website and you just want to serve some recipes or whatever. You're just like the, you know, the lowest hanging fruit out there. It's villagers, you know, and you're going to get napalmed by some bots running at the behest of some massive megatech corporation that just want to scoop up all your stuff for their AI. But you know what's happening is it's destroying the web. It's destroying small
web. Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. That is a massive concern. I was reading some scientific reports about people comparing what is happening to information on the internet, especially the web, to there's a difference between steel. I'm way out of my comfort zone here, but there's a difference between steel produced before nuclear weapons testing and after nuclear weapons testing and nuclear weapons incidents. I might be talking about the wrong metal. This isn't really my wheelhouse.
I've heard this, and I believe there's a solid basis to what you're saying. Yeah.
So finding metal, this particular common metal that has not been tainted by nuclear radiation, and having to have that pure metal for scientific research purposes or whatever, that's really precious to them. Just like data on the web prior to 2022 is precious.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Other people who are sitting on huge amounts of untainted, I hate the phrase intellectual property, but I'll say that content, you know, that has never been released. It's never been put out there. And they don't want to, they're reluctant to, because they know that now anything that you put on the web now is instantly going to become part of the annealing, part of the training data. I mean, that's an opportunity as well as a problem, right? I mean, we can, you know, we know about poisoning AIs. Perhaps we can.
Cloudflare, they make solutions for anti-DDoS and stuff like that, right? They announced recently that one of their default features now is to prevent Gen AI scraping bots from scraping a website's data.
Yeah, we're seeing that across the software field, actually, in cybersecurity. There's a lot of companies moving into that area. And we do something quite similar on the show, don't we, Andy? I think people think that the music is adding for atmospheric, but it also prevents AI bots from scraping.
Oh, very clever.
Definite ways around it. You see artists who are watermarking or purposely damaging some of their artwork in some way so that the AI can't reproduce it. And we're already seeing articles about AI poisoning. You know, it's recycling the same old tat over and over and over and over and over again. And it's going to continue to do that because it's not as advanced as they anticipated when they released it. That the code is still not up to standard. It's still just going to produce what it already has in its database.
That's going to be a massive problem. And it's a lot of us have the theory that one of the reasons why Microsoft, for instance, is shoving Copilot onto Windows 11, and not just that, but their software that suite that used to be called Microsoft Office, that they rebranded Office 365 to make it SaaS, and then they rebranded that as Microsoft 365. Now they've decided to call all that software Microsoft Copilot.
Yeah, and it tricks you. So I use it for one of my jobs. I'm sure most of the world do. And what I've noticed is when you try and move the mouse across the screen, it will accidentally bring up the text prompt quite regularly. And you're like, oh, I can see how people might accidentally be entering data in here without noticing that it's changed from their Word document to the AI box. Or it'll drop down a little thing and say, hey, do you want AI to change this for you? And every time I get that or it comes up, I'm like, oh, you sneaky asses. Like,
it's horrible. It's horrible. It's horrible.
Microsoft products are poison. They're just,
yes.
They're a cybersecurity catastrophe. And I teach that from day one, right?
Unless they have software, though. Like, they have to patch it, and that's something that we talk about. It's like, they can use it, but then they need to invest thousands of pounds a year to put on those plasters, right, to patch a system that is inherently broken.
It's a constant battle of attrition against something that needn't be a problem. And it's just, you know, I don't want this conversation to go there, really, to be honest with you, because there's just so much to say and all of it's incredibly negative.
Well, a theory that a lot of us have is the reason why they're doing that and they're tricking you into accidentally using Copilot and whatnot is because they now want to. And then another disturbing feature of Copilot, where they take snapshots of whatever you're doing on your endpoint at various periods of time. And yeah. They swear that and having OneDrive, I think, is probably pretty concerning too.
Absolutely. They're full of shit in every juncture, every capacity. They are full of shit.
Is they're trying to take our data from our endpoints to train Gen AI on because the internet is becoming a less and less valuable collection of training data.
To them, yeah. I think what it comes down to is that the tools that you use, and this is Ivan Illich, Tools for Conviviality, right? And also Martin Heidegger, who analyzes technology a lot in his philosophy. The tools that you use should not be your enemies. They are extensions of yourself. So this is where IA comes in. So I'm a massive advocate of IA, which is the opposite of AI, right? IA is intelligence amplification. That's the way that computers should be used. They are an extension of the mind-body, as you say, like Jobs, like a bicycle for the mind, right? It's a tool which extends your cognitive capacity and reach in the newer sphere in space and time and so on. But it's, you know, but now what we have is software which is your enemy. You're locked into a tooth and nail battle with it from the get-go for dominance. And you know that's becoming people's experience of computing and software. Constantly,
horrible,
you are embattled with it, right? And that is not what any of us as computer scientists ever intended or wanted to happen. And we need to get together and act to stop it now.
Absolutely. And that's partly why I founded Stop Gen AI. There are two things that Stop Gen AI, which is a very, very, very grassroots organization, there are two things that we're focused on right now. So one of them is having a mutual aid fund to give people survival money if their livelihoods have been displaced by Gen AI. We haven't had a lot of donations, but we've had so far a couple of grand worth of donations, and we've been able to help a few people who are struggling to survive pay immediate bills, buy groceries. So we would like to be able to do a lot more. We would like to be able to help a lot more people who are struggling to survive, but that's another reason for me to mention it on this show, so more people know that our group exists, and if they can spare the money, we would be very happy to receive their donations.
You're listening to The Cyber Show. www.cybershow.uk.
So then the other thing that we focus on is educating the general public. As far as we're concerned, corporate executives, powerful people like that, they're a lost cause. We have zero interest in swaying opinions in the boardroom or swaying opinions of people in Silicon Valley, for instance, who have drunk the Kool-Aid. We are not interested in appealing to those people or trying to change their minds.
You can't do this. I feel the conflict within you. Let go of your hate.
It is too late for me, son.
What we do want to do is actually educate people who are worth the energy to expend on, which is the general public. And I'm sure your average person who knows very little about IT still is very disturbed by their experience on their phones and on social media and on their laptops. And they know that there's something crooked going on, even if they can't explain how or why. I saw a YouTuber talk about how when they use Excel now and they try to enter data into a cell, Copilot covers up most of the cell.
Yeah.
And it's deliberately designed that way so you will accidentally click on the Copilot icon.
Right.
Right? And I don't blame ordinary people for a second if they accidentally use Gen AI, because they are maliciously designing the UI like that. Or if their employers force them to use Gen AI, I don't blame those people at all, right? I do blame people who deliberately choose to use Gen AI. But my point is, our website, now it's a growing resource, and we're hoping to improve it as time goes on. But we have a page on our website that explains how people can get Gen AI out of their lives. My personal computing, there is no Gen AI in anything. And in order to get to that point, I replaced vanilla Android on my phone with Graphene OS, which is only an option if you have a Pixel phone, but you know that there are other Android forks as well. And that's mainly to stop Google from being able to force Gemini on my phone, which was really starting to concern me. I had vanilla Android 15 and I kept seeing signs of them trying to shove Gemini in. And I bit the bullet and I installed Graphene OS. If you don't have a Pixel Android phone, there are alternative forks of Android that you can consider as well.
There are some that will allow you to remove that from the phone, despite the fact that it is a Google phone. So I have a phone where I could just get rid of it. I can get rid of anything that the operating system installs and my phone will just run it. So, and that is becoming, actually, that's an advert now that you see from two major manufacturers. So there is this pushback against AI. And I think it goes back to what Andy said, and it goes back to this power and this warfare, is that we shouldn't be fighting our machines. People have had enough of being at war with their machine, with their device, and it's become marketable.
Yeah, it's marketable in the sense that consumers would like to hear that, yes. Unfortunately, Microsoft and OpenAI, and I think Microsoft owns a big chunk of OpenAI, NVIDIA, Google, Meta, and all that, they have drunk the Kool-Aid, and there is a figure that I have been using quite a lot lately that came from Forbes, that the industry has so far sunk at least $3.44 trillion, a jaw-dropping amount of money. If you were to convert that into pounds, it's probably...
Let's convert that into something else. I mean, it's it sounds scary, but... $3-4 trillion. It's only like one Vietnam and one Iraq war, and we lost both of those, right?
Yeah, I mean, you could do multiple NASA missions for $3.4 trillion, at least. If you're, you know, I think I wrote in a blog last week that you could have NASA missions where you are sending a probe to the moon. You could do that probably a few thousand times for $3.4 trillion.
The question is always why. What was going on? What's the why? Right. And in Europe, we interview people all the time. In Europe, we see that people in senior positions. I know you say that you don't want, you know, you're not intending to speak to them, but we do, and we hear them, and you might be surprised by how much very senior people and decision makers in Europe know and understand that big tech is poison, and that the techno-fascist agenda, and especially coming as is coming from the US at the moment, is poison to democracy, to liberal way of life, to wealth and prosperity for everybody. And there are different perspectives out there that understand that let them spend their stupid money on this stupid, undereducated, overenthusiastic schoolboy project, because you can see where it's going to land, right? I really think we'll be looking back in kind of 20 years. Remember the last AI hype cycle? Remember when that thing happened around about 2025, when everybody just went completely batshit insane, trying to pretend that, you know, this was going to change the world?
I think the main reason why I've quoted that figure is I have encountered people who think that proposing legislation is an effective anti-Gen AI strategy. And I'm trying to explain to those people, no industry sinks that much money into something without making sure that every single politician with any ability to propose legislation that would make that a little more challenging to be profitable.
Yeah, they've been bought, paid for, absolutely. And the person that I respect most for pointing that out, and I will rag on insular cloistered academics who write articles for journals that like 10 people read in computing ethics. But Carissa Vallès from the Oxford group here, she had the chutzpah and it was honourable enough to call out the complete sham that Bletchley Park was. Well, I haven't heard much from her since. Good honor, basically.
Well, there goes our grant money.
My limited sense of what's going on in the zeitgeist, in the thinking of people in general, it's a downhill battle. You don't have to do much work. People hate AI. They hate AI with a visceral passion before they even know what they're really talking about. In fact, that there are really intelligent people who are fellow computer scientists who should know better, maybe, who also passionately hate AI, and they're falling for the trick of conflating Markov chain mafia, I call them, like this LLM shit, right? Yeah, it makes impressive words and pictures and whatever, with real AI.
Yeah.
What scientists have been doing, computer scientists like me, have been doing for 30, 40, 50 years.
Absolutely.
And I was making perceptrons back in the 1990s, writing them in C code. And we were using them to do like medical imaging, right? The AI that spots cancer diagnosis for your auntie Dottie and saves her life is not the same AI that these pushers and snake oil salesmen are trying to foist on you through your smartphone. It's not the same stuff.
One of our members does machine learning research, because I think mainly what you're talking about is the machine learning application of AI.
All of it's going to involve some element of machine learning. We're looking at machines and we want them to learn. There are many, many ways that they can learn, and many ways that they can encode knowledge, and many ways that they can apply that knowledge in a utility context later. The current breakthrough with transformers, which leads to this fast annealing for large dimensional spaces, mostly media, right? Words, pictures, sound, etc. It's a very limited consumerist media utility. It can produce fancy looking, clever things that we can bore ourselves stupid with. But we're very, very going to quickly exhaust the novelty of that.
I think you're right that, you know, in 2023, people are mainly curious. But now they're seeing Gen AI do creepier and creepier things in their lives. And now the opinion amongst ordinary people is generally very negative. Every time a startup out of Silicon Valley or a large tech company out of Silicon Valley says, we now have implemented Gen AI into this, that, and the other. They post about that, and then on social media, people trash them.
So here's a controversial, well, difficult question, I guess. How do we support and protect and champion those people who want to use genuine advances in computer science for honorable aims in social sciences, in medicine, in all kinds of areas that we could benefit from them, from these con artists and greedy big tech corporations who want to foist a technology onto the general populace as a means of control? I mean, how do we draw a distinction between those two projects and make people aware? Because I think I hate the term AI so much because it's a deception by conflation. It takes a whole bunch of things, good things and bad things, and it throws them together in such a way as to deliberately cultivate ignorance.
Yeah, some of the people I know agree that people like Sam Altman started calling it Gen AI deliberately to conflate it with the more legitimate things done in computer science that are called AI. I know that there are very useful applications for machine learning because I've done a lot of research and written documentation and whatnot about SEEM. Less about SOAR, but I understand SOAR as well. There is a machine learning, some people are detecting cyber threats active in the network to sometimes reduce false positive alerts and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, SEEM vendors now are talking about Gen AI. One of our most active members is a woman who works in software engineering named Neha. A lot of her work is directly concerning machine learning. And we do believe that people like Sam Altman deliberately chose to call it Gen AI. So it's like a throwing the baby out with the bathwater sort of thing. The other not harmful application of AI that I think about, because I am such a big fan of video games, is how it's used in video games and how it's been used. Making the baddies in a video game behave a certain way. Also, procedural generation has been very common in video games since the 1990s. I'm going to launch an itch.io bundle if itch.io cooperates with me. It's ready to launch and they're making it problematic right now. But when I was looking for people to contribute games to that bundle, I was asked, oh, if my game has procedural generation, that's not good, right? No, we have Stop Gen AI has nothing against procedural generation. Stop Gen AI has absolutely nothing against the little bit of code in your video game that tells the baddie to react to your actions in a certain way.
What you're saying, Kim, is very important. I work with artists who love and use these kinds of tools, generative composition. I have done for years. We have all different names for, you know, stochastic composition, aleatoric composition, all this stuff. And it's part of the tradition. I mean, modern composition incorporates procedural, generative, genetic algorithm, self-organizing maps, clustering. Well, these tools are as natural to artists now as kind of ink and paper were to composers in days of yore. So I'd love to get you on the show with maybe some of these artists who work with procedural methods, right? They don't see them as AI. So what we're identifying here, and this is where I think Gen AI is a misnomer. It's not a useless term, but it does us a disservice because what we're fighting against here is not the use of many of these tools and the utility of them. It's the way that they're used and who gets to control them and who sets the agenda of what they can and can't do and in whose hands they exist. As a creative person, I want tools that are bicycles for the mind. I want tools that will extend my range and my capabilities, but leave me with the dignity of my creativity. What I don't want, AI, which is really, I was trying to explain this to my 9-year-old. She says, what is AI? I said, it's fake people.
Yeah.
It's fake people, right? They're not real people. And she said, oh, that's a bit disturbing, a bit weird. Why are they not real people? Don't they have a soul? And I said, no, they don't have a soul.
It costs money to have a soul.
It's a demonic project, right? Filling up the world with fake people.
Yeah.
It's a demonic project.
Science fiction has warned about this for a long, long time now, right? Yeah. But, you know, instead of looking at these works of science fiction that were produced all throughout the 20th century, like Philip K. Dick and tons of other science fiction authors, and thinking, so they're warning us not to do this, they're thinking, oh, that sounds cool, let's do it.
Are we just going to blame Star Trek again? Because like everything they make in Star Trek becomes reality within 10 years.
Oh, but you see, Gene Roddenberry is a humanist. Here's the irony. Roddenberry, absolute humanist to the core. Many of those deeper themes, especially in the early Star Treks, are really pro-human. Now, the AI movement and a lot of the big tech movement, a lot of the West Coast stuff, is anti-humanists. They call themselves post-humanists and so on. They're heavily informed by the Russian Orthodox cosmist sects and cults. It's a cult, right? They believe in ascendance, in which they will upload their brains to like the cloud and all this kind of stuff. Honestly, they're clinically insane mindset, right? As dangerous as the rapture people from the far right Christian kind of sects of America. People are openly talking about shutting down certain kinds of speech because it's dangerous, right? I mean, that's the thing, right? We talk about disinformation and what to do about it. To my mind, what's happening with AI at the moment is cult disinformation. It's dangerous speech, and we really need to look at how to counter it as a matter of urgency.
Are the robots, robots. No time for music or love. We are efficient. We'll make you just like us. We are the robots. Download the cloud to our brains. We are efficient. We are completely insane.
You would think with how unpopular Gen AI is with the general public, that organizations like ours would get a lot more fundraising than a few hundred dollars a week.
I had a screenshot I wanted to show you of what happened when I researched your org, and I typed in stop Gen AI, all one word. So it's a unique identifier, it's a single string. And the search engines just produced loads of pro AI videos. fuck, what did you expect, right?
That's deliberate design on the search engine's part, obviously.
Of course it is.
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
If anyone listening, please visit stopgenai.com. The website looks very 1998 Web 1.0 because I developed the public-facing part of the website and I'm not a glitzy web developer. There's links to our fundraising. We are considering launching some t-shirts that have art on them made by a human being for our organization. Anyone who donates $10 or more gets a Stop Gen AI email address. Thank you so much. You have been, all of you, you've been wonderful, and I really appreciate this. Thank you so much, Andy. Thank you so much, Helen. You've been great.
You've been great too.
All right, take care.
See you later. Bye.